Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. Hello to all of you out there. For this episode, I spoke with Jamie Holka, a guitarist who I would absolutely describe as among the very best. As you'll hear in this interview, there's no magic formula to getting good at an instrument. You have to put the work in and the hours in. Jamie has a dedication to his craft that reminds me why it's important to focus on what's the most fundamental aspect of the music business. And that is the simple, basic commitment to the art. He's also a thoughtful and kind person, which is why I had such a good time getting to know him a little bit. So sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with the one and only Jamie Holka. Jamie Holka, my first question for you, how does it feel to live in one of the seven wonders of the world?
I've lived here my whole life, 47 years, and every time I go to visit the falls, which isn't all the time, you know, but I mean, I've seen it my entire life, and the falls itself blows my mind every single time.
Never gets old, right?
Ever. It's amazing.
So
it's
you think it does deserve to be called one of the seven wonders of the world?
Hands down. It's unbelievable, truly. I mean, people see it for the first, people, you know, travel from around the globe to see it. And I live there, you know, and I've never moved away. I was gone for 1 year, for school once. And, it's never not mind blowing ever.
Have you ever been to any of the other of the seven wonders of the world? There's six others, which I don't know any of them. Is it one that...
Ric Flair, the wrestler, wasn't he one of the wonders of the world? I'm kidding. No, I've never been.
Well, you know what? I might do a little research and
was Ric Flair one of them?
I think he might.
Nature Boy?
Nature Boy's one of the seven wonders of the world. So now you know, too.
But the falls is not considered correct, is it not?
I think it is. Or maybe we just said that. Maybe we just made that up.
I think there's a little bit of a...
There's a controversy?
I think so.
Come on.
I believe so.
That's wrong.
Because they consider the pyramids and they consider...
There's some other falls.
And there's other falls.
Like a skinny, higher...
Skinny falls.
Yeah.
Like skinny jeans.
Skinny falls, yeah.
Which I don't care for either. I saw a guy, I was on the road over the summer, back in May... And he was the hotel owner where we were down in Orlando. And he was about, you know, our age. And he was wearing skinny jeans. And I was just like, you know, I'm not quite certain if, you know, he didn't have a skateboard. If he would have a skateboard, then.
But it was in Florida. So
yeah,
it should have been skinny shorts.
But
then.
He was a foreigner. He was from another land, you know.
Florida is sort of already like, sort of like. As I like to call it, the penis of America.
Well,
if you think of it,
it resembles
on the map,
one. Yeah. Yeah.
It's, do you mind if I just stop this to see if our. Already we've got some gold here, but
good.
I just want to make sure it's recording. Okay, hold on. Still, we're back and I'm still talented at this, hitting that record button.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I do in this podcast. Is I look up other people with your name and I find out a little bit about them and I tell you about it because I just think it's interesting.
People with my name?
There's not many.
The one that keeps getting arrested?
Is there? Do you know what?
It's a girl, too. It's funny.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't find out about her.
Okay.
I found out about a guy named Jamie Holka.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he was ever arrested, but he lived in...
A shoe? Sorry.
He lived in, sweet baby Jesus. Come on. Well, he died in 1944.
He's still dead.
I think we're back, and we were just rudely interrupted by a photo cleaner thing on my computer, on my MacBook.
How dare they?
But I was saying about this guy named Jamie Holka, who he worked here. Look at that, Sinclair Petroleum.
Yeah, I know that gas station. Czechoslovakia. See, people think Holka is a Polish name. It's a Czech name. I've always told people that.
Yeah, we're back on the air now because we're trying again. You're learning more about your alter ego, Jamie Holka.
James, yeah, because I'm actually James as well. And my mother named me James, but she wanted to call me Jamie. Yep. That was the initial intention, but she wanted to give me a, you know, biblical name on the birth certificate. So it's funny to look at that because he was born in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, he was born in 1873 in Czechoslovakia.
Oh, man, we're almost 100 years apart. I was born in 71.
Oh, my gosh, really? And yeah, he lived in East Chicago Lake, Indiana. And he was in, there's a draft card for World War I for him. He was in World War I.
Really? Yes. That is awesome, man.
And the name Holka, yes.
It means working girl in Czechoslovakian
language.
Are
you serious?
Yeah.
That's like the best thing ever. So it's a Czech name.
Czech name. And people always think it's Polish because Polka, Holka. They think it's, you know, oh, you're Polish, right? And go, nah, it's Czech name. So.
And do you know the Czech are beautiful people? Like every Czech person I've ever known is physically beautiful and
really
super nice and warm.
And then I came along.
I think you're right in there. You're right in there, Jamie James Holka. He was in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
He lived to be 70 years old. He died in 1944 after retiring from Sinclair Petroleum.
That's cool, man. That's really cool.
And I looked at the name, like, you look at the name Holka, and it says, I don't know how they find this information, but Holkas are known for being workers, like physical workers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And a lot of Holkas live and lived in Michigan.
We had a cousin of ours, a relative, years ago, many years ago, probably, you know, oh God, I don't know, 25 years ago or so, came around to my parents' house when my dad was alive, and he was a Michigan Holka, and he brought a family tree. He was researching, excuse me, the name and the you know, everybody, and he gave my dad like the list of all of the Holkas in the world that he had found, and there was a bunch in Michigan, and that was where the majority of them in the U.S. were in Michigan, yeah.
You mentioned your dad, which actually I want to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
I have some recollection that your dad was an athlete of some sort. Is that true?
Unbelievable athlete.
Tell me about him.
It's funny, I was telling this today because I was telling you, I went to my mechanic, and his dad had just passed, and he was telling me about his dad. And we got on to talking about our fathers today, so I play, you know, it seems like the last few years I've been playing some of these, you know, jobs that I do, these gigs, and these old timers come up to me and they go, "Hey, was your dad Hank?" And I go, "Yeah." And like, "Oh man, you should see, he was the best diver I ever saw, ever. He, you know, best swimmer, best diver. His main, what he was known for was he was a diver. But he fought in the Golden Gloves. You know, that was his only loss.
Really?
Yeah, it was his only loss when he fought I think he fought at like 130 pounds. I think he was like a flyweight. He's a boxer. He was a diver. He was a swimmer. He pole vaulted. He pole vaulted back when they used bamboo.
You'd have to say Czech vaulted.
Is that what it is?
Polish.
Is it? back, this is like bamboo pole and land on sand. He told me, I said, "Dad, what was your highest pole vault?" He goes, 11 feet. And you think, 11 feet. Then you look at a basketball rim and go, well, that's 10. So, you know.
He went over with just a bamboo
foot,
pole,
bamboo
a run
pole.
And plant it and over.
Yep.
How did that happen? How did he become an athlete? Do you have any idea?
He had no father. So he had nobody, no father figure in his life ever. He had five brothers. His oldest brother was the first soldier from Niagara Falls, New York to die in World War II. So he was left with his other, so the rest of my uncles, the rest of them were, to say the least, kind of misfits, alcohol you know, gambling kind of guys. And my dad had no, you know, his father left the family when my dad was born, or when my aunt was born, right after my father. Same scenario, alcoholic, didn't raise him. So my dad was raised by his mother and this family of, like I said, boys that were wayward. And sports were his, the boys club was his refuge. He used to hang out at the boys club, and that's where he, you know, learned how. But when he went out to become, when he became a diver and all that stuff, I says, Dad, who was your coach? He goes, there was no diving coach. There was a swimming coach. I go, how'd you learn how to dive? He goes, I taught myself.
Seriously?
Yeah. Taught himself how to dive. And, you know, the picture on my Facebook page is him diving. It's a picture of him. I didn't see it till the day he died. He died 2.5 years ago. And I never saw that picture till we were at the funeral home. My mother brought all these pictures out. And it was a picture of him. He was lifeguarding at a boys camp in Pennsylvania. And there's like, so he would just, you know, do this, like at lunchtime, they would close the pool and he would practice diving. So this picture of him, if you actually click on the picture, there's like all these little kids along the fence, just like staring up at him. Okay. He's in this, it's just so cool.
Hank Holka.
Hank. Yeah.
What was his job? Like, did he do that on the side or did he do that as a vocation? Like, was he an athlete?
No, because this was, you know, this was his high school years. So he went to the Korean War and then him and my mother got married and he became, well, first he drove cab for a few years and that was driving cab. So then he became an electrician. That was his main gig. That was his job for 35 years.
I feel like there's some sort of a work ethic, obviously, that I think you got from him. I know you got from him because it brings to mind, there's two things that you said to me that I want to bring up. And I want you to maybe reflect on them. So I remember, and these were both times when I had you be the guest artist at the open mic that I hosted at Moonshiners.
Yep.
R.I.P. Moonshiners. It was a great place.
Yeah, right. It was.
You said one time, I asked you, I said, you are so good on that guitar. Do you practice all the time? And you said, well, you know what? I've played for so long that I don't ever say the word practice. I play.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for whatever reason, that stuck in my head, and that honestly means a lot to me. I think of that, it changes the whole feeling about what you're doing. To me, practice always seemed like a chore. Playing is like a gift. So there was that part. And then the other part of this was you said to me that this is what you do for a living. You play guitar for a living. And you said you figured out a long time ago that if you were going to support your family, you had to figure out how to actually be able to make a living at doing it.
Right? Sure, sure.
So can you talk about those two concepts?
Yeah, I mean, excuse me, I mean, first of all, you know, when I first started playing guitar, I mean, I was 13 years old. And by the time I started playing, I was already listening to music since I was small, like 5 years old. I've been talking about this a lot lately. It's weird because I got roped into this Led Zeppelin tribute over the summer. And we've done a few gigs now. And like Led Zeppelin was like the first band that like I went nuts over, you know. And it wasn't just Page's guitar playing. It was the band, you know, the music.
Like
you know?
Vibe.
Right. Energy. It wasn't just, you know, that component, the playing. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so by the time I started playing guitar, I mean, I had been listening to music and buying my own records. And like, I used to, you know, put on Zeppelin 1 in third grade and just sit there and listen to it and stare at the back cover and, you know, read the liner notes and just like sit there and listen and flip the album over and just listen to it over and over. And I, you know, back then I was playing Little League baseball. I mean, I wasn't even playing guitar. I wasn't even playing music. You know, I just loved it. And so, you know, when I first started playing, and it's funny because this weekend I have to induct in the Niagara Falls Music Hall of Fame my first guitar teacher. He asked me if I would induct him. He got, you know.
Sweet.
I was thinking about this stuff. Just like yesterday, I had to start writing down what I'm going to say this Sunday, you know, and, you know, I used to practice whatever he showed me. I was into sports. Like, my dad was into sports. But when I found the guitar, I realized, well, if you're going to be any good, you better really put your all into it. So I would, starting in like ninth grade, I would practice four or five hours a day after school on the guitar. And that was practice. You know what I mean? I would, you know.
Was it at that point fun for you, or did you have a end result in mind? Did you do it because you wanted to get better, or did you do it because you just loved the act of doing it?
I think it was both. I mean, I knew that, and you know, the other funny thing about me that I don't bring up too often, because most kids played Little League baseball and Tyro football like I did too, and I was good at both. But the thing that I really got into right before I played guitar for a couple years was karate, and I'm not blowing my own horn, I'm just saying what happened. I started studying karate when I was 10, and right before I turned 13, I got my black belt. And I used to work out the karate thing. That was another like 4 days a week. Like, I ended up having a key to the school when I was like 11 years old, because me and this guy used to go in before anybody got there, and we would leave when everybody, we would, you know,
11. They trusted you with that. You were responsible enough with that.
Yeah.
You were disciplined enough with that.
The discipline, that was the whole thing. So the discipline from that carried over for me. And just like when I played football, I mean, you practiced 5 days a week. You know, karate was 5 days a week, 4 days a week. So guitar, I figured,
it sort of fell into that.
It's the same thing. I thought it was the same thing. If you're going to be worth it, if you're going to be any good. You know, time went on, and I just my high school years were spent studying the guitar, practicing the guitar. And I'm still studying. I still feel like the same way about it, but it got to the point where you realize it's about the music. There's technical stuff you got to have together if you're going to be, you know, convincing when you're playing. But there comes a point too where you got to play music, you know? So you got to strike the balance of, like, some people have great feel, you know, and great ears and all that stuff, and they're good, you know? And then there's other guys that got all the technique in the world, and you're like, after a couple of minutes, you know, mm-hmm. It's only so interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. So I've always struggled with the, how do you balance, you know, the two worlds.
Because
I love tunes. I love songs, you know. But I'm not a songwriter. I mean, I've written songs over the years and stuff, and written a lot of originals with other singers who wrote the lyrics and all that, wrote a lot of music. I mean, it's...
Was it, coming to the second part of that point,
mm-hmm.
Was it difficult, obviously, to support a family based on it? Like, first of all, did you have to take gigs and play gigs that really you weren't feeling?
I still do.
Okay. And still, the joy of when you, that outweighs any of the things doing that you don't want to do, correct?
Sure. Yeah, for sure.
Did any of the fact that you had to do it ruin the fact of how much you love it?
You know, lately, I feel a little bit of that, you know, like, especially when summertime, like I was just telling you how busy my summers are.
Can you say it again? Like, tell me about your summer.
I play 6 nights a week for, you know, June, July, and August, you know, it's not just 6-7 nights a week. It's that I will play like in those 3 months, right? What's there, like 90 days, you know, I'll play 80 times, 85 times. You know, in those 3 months, you know what I mean? And sometimes you're just going like, oh man, really? Like, I got to go do this again. Mm-hmm. I got to run from this one to that one. I've only got this much time. Even like last Friday, I played at, in Buffalo, Coulter Bay. I played, what the hell is it? Delaware and Allen. I played from 6 to 9 and I had to be on at 10 o'clock in the falls. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like, not only are you doing 2-3 hour gigs back to back, but you got 1 hour from the time the one ends to the time the other one starts.
And no time to decompress.
And none. Zero.
The other part of that.
Zero.
The playing is one thing, but then it's the, you know, people are nice enough to come out and listen to you.
That's right.
And they're excited to see you. And guess what you have to be?
You got to be on.
Yep.
You got to shake hands and smile and hugs and kisses and that's right.
And that's, I mean, nothing against that because we like that, but
of course.
But that is hard to do when you are feeling anything but that, right?
Right, and it's not like like you watch a professional athlete and they'll complain that, oh man, we've been playing every night. Well, yeah, you guys are making millions of dollars. You know what I mean? We're going out making $100 a night.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a big difference. You know what I mean? It's like...
And carrying our own shit to
carrying our own shit and...
loading, unloading, and, you know...
All that. Yeah. And people don't get that, you know? And, you know, you always get the, oh, you're so lucky. You get to do what you love. And, you know, and I go, yeah, you're right. But I don't love, you know... I don't love, you know, having no time to get from one place to the other. I don't love carrying, you know... amps and speakers and all that, you know, but that's, it's just, you know,
that's what I tell my students and young people. A lot of young people who want to be musicians listen to this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I can honestly tell them is the, when it's good, those moments of when it's that pure bliss that actually outweighs all of the bullshit because there is so much of it.
Right.
I say to myself so many times, I must really love this because what am I doing, right? But you do really love it that much.
You know, I tell people if they, you know, because people, it's funny is now that I've, you know, we've been doing this so long now. And there's guys that are my heroes that have been doing it longer. You know what I mean? A lot longer. And, but I mean, I just tell people that it's not like you chose it. It chose you is how I like to think of it. You know, because if you had, you know, choices, you would probably make different choices. But when you feel like it was you, it picked you, then it doesn't really matter what happens. You know what I mean? Whether it's good or bad, you know, I always say, it's funny, I got a guitarist. I only have a handful of guitar students anymore. I used to teach all kinds of lessons because it was like, you know, you can make some money and I wasn't playing as much as, you know, 20 years ago as I do now. And it's funny because the other day, one of my students has been with me a long time. He's old timer, man. Cool cat. He's like 77 years old. He goes, Jamie, he goes, how long have you been doing this? We got into it all. And he goes, if somebody came up to you and says, hey, I got a job for you. You can make $100,000 a year doing whatever. And I go, well, what would that be? And he's like, well, what else would you like to do? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, the only thing I would really love to do, the only thing I really like to do is I like to play tennis. I go, but ain't nobody paying me $100,000 to play tennis a year. I'm going to tell you right now. So I says, no, man. I says, this is it. It's like, you do it. It's like being married, for better or for worse, right? You do it for better or for worse. And you work as hard as you can. You put your best foot forward all the time. Is it always going to be great? Is it always going to be? But, you know, I've hung in there so long and tried to be versatile, if you know, as versatile as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still so much I'd like to be able to do on the instrument and just overall.
Yeah.
So it's cool, man. Like, I'm never going to have to learn. I'm never going to have to do crossword puzzles when I get old. Because I'm trying to remember Steely Dan tunes, you know what I mean? And I don't have to, you know what I mean? The way, you know what I'm saying? Like people, oh, I got to start working your mind. It's like, no, I don't have to work my mind. I got so many songs that I have memorized, you know? I just feel like it was, you know, it's what I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
As far as, and we're all just little specks of sand. I mean, right? So,
you know, I'm struggling with something right now recently, and that's this. I work several jobs. I'm a college instructor, right, in several different places, and I teach English as a second language classes. And I did all of that because I got to be a 40-year-old single woman, and I was looking at $100 a week for maybe three times a month, right? So I panicked. And so I got my master's degree, and I got jobs. And now, so fast forward to now, I'm happy. I have a house. I have lots of jobs, like, but I am trying to figure out how I can quit all of that and go back to this, what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
And it's where I am right now, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like talking to you is sort of inspiring because you said, yeah, I was not really born to do any of that other stuff. But it's, here we go.
Yeah, I mean, what you did, though, is you're a songwriter. You know, I'm a guitar player. So, I mean, my world is more trying to, like, I mean, it's been different through the years, but I mean, when I started playing the solo thing, like when I would come and do your
open mic, which is when I first really got to know you, and that just blows my mind.
But yes. That was the stuff, that kind of thing was kind of me entertaining myself, you know, like learning, okay, what song do I want to try to, you know, work out? Oh, I want to play the Zeppelin tune. Oh, I mean, I want to do the Steely Dan tune.
Parts, by the way, you do the rhythm. Yeah. You'd be the whole band, including the melody.
Yeah. On a good day, yeah. I mean, I just, like, you know, Nancy Reagan just said no to drugs. I just say no to loopers and backing tracks. I just, you know, if I can't play it, I can't play it. You know, I don't want some contraption. That's just me. You know, I don't know, you know, not to dog the guys that do that. No. Some guys do it really creatively. They do.
I don't see how anybody. I can just only handle the chord to the amp. I don't really, anything in between, if your feet are going right. And your hands are going, right. I might as well be a drummer.
Well, you know? I mean, God, I talked about this today too. It's like, but writing music, like what you do, I mean, to try to be a songwriter, a singer-songwriter, but it's the same thing for guitar players. There's a million of us. There's a million singer-songwriters. Yeah. There's a million guitar players. You know, so all you can do is hope that your vision is correct of what you are pursuing, you know, and how you see yourself, you know.
Right, because you hope that it's not, you hope there's something actually to it.
Well, you hope that, yeah, people get it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so what if it's, you know, I mean, like, guitar players are real guilty of over, you know, being, like, it's too much guitar. It's too much of this thing, like, that you think is so cool, but the average listener couldn't care less about it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's about music. You know, it's about playing music, you know, mm-hmm. period, you know, and... I don't know. It's a never ending pursuit.
It's like being maybe a surfer or something. There's always another wave. Like,
right.
And that's the cool thing about it. Right. Sure. Like, you can always go deeper. You can always go further. Right?
Sure. Oh yeah. There's no right.
So it's a lifelong.
If you have, like I said, if you have a vision, if you have the vision to know, you know, when and where to kind of. I don't know, shift gears?
Yeah, speaking of shifting gears, I want to ask you, there's one more, like, chunk of stuff I want to ask you about, and then we'll take a little break, and we'll talk about the person that you chose today, okay?
Sure, sure.
But what I want to talk about is, like shifting gears. So I did a little research on you, and I found out, like, some of the different groups you've worked with and are working with. And so what I want to ask you is, like, sort of like a back and forth a little bit, how did the thing you were doing or the band you were in, how did that change your approach to playing? Okay, so for example, let's start with, you went to school at Berklee School of Music, right?
Yep.
And so in that mode, mm-hmm. give me like the nutshell version of what was your guitar playing like during that era?
I was 20 years old. Excuse me. I was kind of, at that point, almost a metal guy. Almost, you know... I was really, I was probably, you know, at that age, I was crossing over. I was listening to still, some of the metal stuff that kind of took me away from the vintage, Zeppelin Deep Purple that I grew up mm-hmm. on. And the metal thing crept in a little bit. And, but what happened to me at Berklee, interestingly enough, and I just got to go back there and play back in June in Boston, and I got to hang out with my Berklee roommate who I hadn't seen since then, and his name was Vladan Milenkovic, and here was he was from Yugoslavia at the time, and I believe now it would be Serbia. They were in civil war at mm-hmm. the time, and not so much the way I played then, as much as what I felt happened to me there was him being my roommate. He was a pianist, and I was 20, so he was like 23-ish, 23, mm-hmm. 24, a little bit older. He was so highly evolved as a musician at that point. Mm-hmm. And here's me, like, you know, trying to, you know, just rip some guitar leads. And I mean, I knew what I was doing. I'm not saying, I'm not downplaying what I could do, but he was already classically trained and steeped in jazz at this point. And he, more than Berklee, the school, he opened my eyes to, there's another world out there, man. There's a whole other level. And I said, this guy's only a few years older than me. And he has applied himself in such a way where he is light years beyond what's going on here in the classroom. And it was so cool that I messaged him on Facebook. I said, hey, man, I'm coming to Boston to play with my band, Captain Beyond. And he's, I'll be there, man. I'll be there. I hadn't seen him in 26 years. 26 years. There he was. We hung out all night, came to the hotel. And I just says, Vlad, man, I want to tell you how much what you could do influenced me to, you know, just, and it's slow. It's such a slow thing to expand your style and to go into these other realms. I mean, it takes forever. It takes years, you know, but he, like I said, him more than Berklee.
That's amazing. And by the way,
yeah.
You.
And why did they put me with him? Why was he right. My roommate?
Right.
If he would have been the roommate, yes. If he would have been the guy down the hall, I would never know nothing.
And yeah, you recognized it too. Being a 20-year-old, you paid attention to that. That was
Oh yeah, it was shit, man. It hit you over the head like a, you know, like a brick, man. I was like, so.
You paid attention though. You paid attention to that.
I tell everybody in life, young people, I say, you know what you need to do in life. I'm not going to tell you. I don't tell anybody what they should do, shouldn't do. But I would tell you one thing: pay attention. Mm-hmm. Pay attention. You know what I'm saying? You got to pay attention.
Right there.
Oh yeah. If you pay attention.
Yep.
That's right.
Next one, Spinning Room, mid '90s, right? That's on
early.
Early '90s.
Early '90s. Yeah.
Tell me about that. And were you writing, collaborating on songs in that? And what was your guitar playing like in that era?
When I was in Spinning Room, I was a young man. Oh, I was young. God, the hair. Oh, man, I was young and thin. Had some hair. Anyways, we were writing. I was trying to be my hero at that point was Hendrix. So everything I did, I was trying to be Jimi Hendrix within my little thing. But it was funny. The first Spinning Room live album, which we did at, it was unintentionally became a live album. Remember when 103.3 PhD, The Fox?
Hell yes, I do.
And Jesse Galante?
Yes.
Well, we did our, whatever night that was, that Wednesday, that live Wednesdays, whatever it was. And they recorded it and we listened to it. We're like, let's put it out. Let's make a record. So that was our live album. And, back then, it was funny because I was in my Hendrix phase, and so I would write lyrics to my, you know, kind of funky tunes. So me and the bass player, John Ryzik, John was a lyricist too, excuse me, and he would write a complete song, I would write a complete song. So all the songs on that first record were written between me and him, mm-hmm. And I don't think...
Did you think about guitar playing differently when you were knowing a song was at the end of it?
I don't know. I don't think so. I was trying to at that point. I mean, that's just like a little, you know, you're in this little bubble at the time and you think everything you do is like great and it's like this profound thing.
I know that.
Thing. Yeah, you think you're influencing the world at this point, but I was very Jimi Hendrix, like when Jimmy played the Monterey Pop Festival, like that, just that real aggressive, you know, funky guitar, you know, like, but with a lot of lead guitar too, and so my lyrics were, I mean, pretty crude. I probably wrote like one or two really cool things or a couple cool lines, but I wasn't a lyricist, you know, but mm-hmm. I wrote a bunch of songs and all that. So, you know, I don't know. I mean,
so could we after that sort of fast forward to mm-hmm. the solo fingerstyle stuff you did right now? I know that you and Bruce mm-hmm. are great. Collaborate, like you guys play together fantastically. So there's that whole era too, right? Of you guys jamming together, which you still do, right?
Yeah, 20 years almost now.
And so that is now you're accompanied by another guitar player who's, so you guys play off each other, right? And there's that whole...
Yeah, we're so different the way we play. That's why that works, you know. You gotta... It never works to have two of the same-minded players, you know. And I... In different situations, you know, like... See, guitar players, it's very common that guitar players have egos slash, you know, neuroses. You know what I mean? It's like to be egomaniacal about the way they play, but also very...
Insecure about very, it at the same time.
At right? the same exact time. It's like the same thing. So I try to, whatever situation I'm in, I try to establish, am I the alpha male, right? Or should I fall in line and follow, you know, because just the other night, we had a fill-in for our normal, we do this every Wednesday gig, and singer couldn't make it. So instead of me calling on another singer, I brought in a friend of mine who is a singer guitar player. And his name is Dave Viterna, and he's from Medina. And Dave is, I mean, the alpha thing in what he does. But he knows a million songs. And he is the ultimate, how do I put this, blue-collar singer, guitar player you'll ever see anywhere in the world. I mean, Dave is phenomenal. I mean, he'll play all of every Buddy Holly tune. And he'll play every Buddy Holly tune perfectly, the way Buddy Holly played it. Like, he doesn't change anything. He plays it perfectly. And then he'll move into anything he plays. It's so perfectly done, you know. Whereas me, I always go, I like to get the flavor of somebody, but I don't try to, I don't, you know what I mean? Yeah. I don't want to, he can. So we had him fill in the other night. And now it's really, at that point, you say, well, it's my gig. But when I bring him in, it's like, no, it's yours.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I'm backing you up, man.
So
you know?
If you don't recognize that, if you don't switch gears, suddenly the show is...
It's a drag.
Yeah, it's a drag.
Yeah.
I just want to talk next about Captain Beyond. So listen, which I looked them up, and my guitar player, Graham, was like, Jamie plays with Captain Beyond, those guys.
Really?
Like, okay, so you've got guys in the band who... Johnny Winter, Deep Purple Band, Iron Butterfly, Rick Derringer, right? It's an American-British rock band, which, when I listen to it, I hear the British. You can pass me one of those bad boys, too.
Here, this is, here, give me your glass.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, what happened was the first...
Go ahead.
That sounds good, don't it?
Yeah, it's going to make everybody thirsty. And we're drinking Guinness because...
Rory Gallagher's beer of choice.
Rory Gallagher's beer of choice. And so I mentioned that in case Guinness wants to be a sponsor of this show and...
Yeah, that wouldn't be too bad.
Jamie
that wouldn't
Holka. Suck. If you want to arrange Guinness to pull up a truck in front of Jamie Holka's house every month...
Not the dead Jamie Holka
no,
from...
Yeah, not the 1940...
The one that's alive, yeah. Still,
and not the
barely.
Criminal Jamie Holka. But the real Jamie Holka. The eighth wonder of the world, Jamie
That's right.
Holka.
So Captain Beyond, the original Captain Beyond, this is all going to tie into Spinning Room, actually.
Okay.
The band we were talking about earlier. The original Captain Beyond was Bobby Caldwell is the original. He's still the guy I play with on drums. And Bobby was Johnny Winter's drummer. There's the biggest Johnny Winter album of his career was Johnny Winter and the band was called Johnny Winter and the live album was the big record. 1970, and I believe it was recorded at the Fillmore East, you know, Bill Graham and all that. And the interesting part about that was that Johnny Winter in 1970 was a bigger act than the Allman Brothers. The opening act on that tour for Johnny Winter was the Allman Brothers. So Bobby Caldwell, who's drummer for Captain Beyond still to this day, used to go and play four or five songs a night with the Allman Brothers because he was friends with Greg and Dwayne. And then he would, you know, because the Almonds always had two drum sets and a set of percussion on stage, because J-Mo and Butch Trucks were the double drum duties and percussion. So there was always, you know, an empty seat, so to speak. And they love Bobby. Bob, they used to call him Fire, because Bobby is, even to this day, this guy is, I'm getting ahead. Anyway, so Bobby played with Johnny Winter and the Allman Brothers. He's the drummer on Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo, Rick Derringer.
Yes.
He's on the whole album, Rick Derringer, All-American Boy.
Really?
Yeah. Which I didn't even know that till, because, who knows who's the drummer on Rock. But I always remember, who's that drummer, man? And I just be like, man, who's that cat? You know, just the way he played, you know. And it's Bobby, you know. So he's also had a band in 1975 called Armageddon. And Keith Ralph was the singer. Well, Keith Ralph was the singer from the Yardbirds. The Yardbirds. Jimmy Page, Clapton, Jeff Beck. Yeah. And Bobby was the drummer, you know. And so, you know, that was for me. For me, to this day, to be playing with Bobby is like, you know, it's a piece of, you know, it's a piece of rock history, you know.
And it's a piece of your formative years, because you are physically, like, it's sort of like a dreams come true thing. Because when you were the little boy listening, that's, you know, you're playing with people who played with him. So you're kind of there.
Well, check this out. So here's what's interesting is I was coming up as a player, a young player, you know, didn't know, you know, shit yet. People from Niagara Falls, guys from Niagara Falls, as it turned out, Niagara Falls had this niche of guys that were Captain Beyond fans, you know. And I used to work at the Colado, the drumstick factory, Regal Tip.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah. And I was young, 18, 19. And my buddy Rick Catnice. This is going to take me a minute, but it's pretty cool. Rick would be like, "Hey, Jamie, what are you into, man? What are you into listening to?" And at the time, you know, probably I was like still kind of coming out of the shredder mode. And I was like, "I don't know, man. Joe Satriani. You know any Captain Beyond?" No. He'd shake his head. "You don't know any Captain Beyond?" "No, man." So now I'm working for the city this next summer, right? And my buddy, who was the crew leader, who's one of my brother's best friends, ultimate, one of the biggest stoners I've ever met to this day, turned me into one for quite some time, turned me on to two people, Tommy Bolin, who was almost my choice for tonight, and Captain Beyond. And he goes, "You know Captain Beyond?" I'm like, "No, I'm tired of people asking me." So I'm like, "Can I swear on this thing? Well, who the fuck is Captain Beyond, you know?" Lays this album on me. Gives me this record, you know, vinyl, full-length vinyl album. I go home and I put it on. The album cover is this 3D cat. Looks like, you know, this 3D, like, Christopher Columbus fucking, I don't know what the fuck, right? So I put this album on and I'm like, holy shit. Well, it turns out the singer was from my previous favorite band, Deep Purple. Rod Evans was the singer that sang Hush, Kentucky Woman. The other two guys were from Iron Butterfly and Agata DeVita. Bobby Caldwell on drums, and this album is just like it's unbelievable. It's just like it's a masterpiece. That first record was a masterpiece.
The 3D Christopher Columbus cat is a masterpiece.
Psychedelic Christopher Columbus, whatever that guy was. And I got guitar picks with it now. It's so bizarre. Anyway, it's really bizarre. It's really strange. So, Spinning Room, my band Spinning Room, I said, "Guys, listen to this shit. Listen to this." And everybody was like, "Oh, my God." So, we immediately started covering Captain Beyond songs. That band was, when we wrote an album, but all of our cover music was obscure, psychedelic, one-hit wonder stuff. We did some Cream, and we did Hendrix, and we did Robin Trower, but we were looking for these oddball, which I'm always looking for that still to this day, oddball tunes, you know, they're just great. And Captain Beyond was like our,
it's like your go-to, or
yeah, and it was kind of like our badge of honor, because there was a whole little congregation of Niagara Falls people, mostly Italian guys, that loved Captain Beyond. I mean, loved them. And there was a band called Zola back in the mid-70s that was covering Captain Beyond as Captain Beyond was current, when they were current. And so, I know this is, the story's nuts, but so as it all kind of comes around, and the story of how I got in the band is another thing, but I still have the guys that were in the band Zola that used to play Captain Beyond in the 70s.
Right.
Got a hold of, made sure they called me and says, Jamie, when you need to get ready to go on the road, we will play these songs with you to get you ready. Because, I mean, I rehearsed in Orlando with Captain Beyond. I mean, so my buddies Tony Beccari, Rick Catney, Vonica Loyan, I go and jam with these guys, and we work out the Captain Beyond stuff. Oh,
sweet. So they're getting your backing tracks to get ready to go out on the road
exactly.
with Captain Beyond.
It's unbelievable. So how do I get picked to play in this band?
Right.
This obscure band.
Right.
And it just so happens there's a band in town. There's a group of guys in town that know all the tunes that say, hey.
Right.
And when I go to Rick's house, it's a full studio. I mean, I was just there last Monday because, you know, it's been... I mean, it's crazy.
Again, you paid attention because, like, it was right there. You just noticed it, right? I mean, honestly, you made all these opportunities for yourself by doing the work. But, I mean, how is it to go on tour? I watched your, like, this video of you guys, and these are big shows, right?
Yeah, some bigger than others, you know, but, I mean... It's kind of like Captain Beyond's kind of like, I equate it to like these bands like Wishbone Ash or, you know, these kind of bands that were like, the story about Captain Beyond though is after they made the second record, they were really close to hitting the big time in the singer, Rod Evans, split. And once he split, it became like, hey, we need a new singer. And, you know, once the lead singer leaves, because he was the voice, yeah. You know. And so that was, because me and Bobby talk all the time about it. They go, man, Bob, you guys, I'll say you guys were a cult band. And he's like, yeah, man. He goes, let me tell you something. If Rod wouldn't have left, Bill Walden, this guy from, they were this close.
Yeah.
The reason they got the first record deal was Greg Allman. Greg Allman got them that first deal. You know what I mean? Because, like I said, Bobby from Johnny Winter, playing with Johnny Winter and the Allmans being their opening mm-hmm. act, and Bobby jamming with those guys, Bobby played at Dwayne Allman's funeral with the Allmans. I mean, he was that tight with those guys, you know? Mm-hmm. And so anyways, I mean, it's just a lot of, it's a lot of history. I mean, for me.
Is it overwhelming sometimes in a good way?
Yeah, I mean, but it's kind of... It's just so weird because it's I'm in an age now that I've gone through a lot of stuff and I've gone through personal stuff, you know, that as much as I would like this to be like a big deal, it's weird. It's like, you know, I don't want to get philosophical, but I think God has a way of always kind of keeping you, you know, keeping you level, you know, no matter what. Uh-huh. And I just think enough things have happened to me in my personal life that have been hard. And when this happened, when I got this gig, I had just got done saying, and I was going, I'm still going through a thing, but we were still going through a hard time when it happened. And I had just got done saying to a friend of mine who was saying, you know, you got to do more to get yourself out there. You got to, because you're this. And I'm like, listen, I said, stop it. I go, I'm 45 years old. It's over. I did. I said, it's over. I says, no one's going to come to Niagara Falls looking for a guitar player. I says, hey, listen, I've had a good run. You know, I'm making a living, you know, just, it's cool. Like, don't worry about me. I'm not going to do anything extra. It's over, you know? And 2 weeks later, two weeks later, man, I get this message on Facebook from a friend of mine who was friends with the guy that does the social media for Captain Beyond. And I'm like, you got to be shitting me, man, because I know Captain, like I knew, you know, I mean, Captain Beyond was personal to me, you know, and I just couldn't believe it. So
did you have to audition or did they give you the gig?
Well, they had a couple guys, that they had, tried.
And did you karate chop them and get rid of them? So then you had.
Yeah, I went. I flew to various parts of the states, and I got people in some headlocks and noogies, and. But yeah, it was. It's just really. I don't know, man. Life is that way, and music is. I mean, even just like I've opened a lot of shows in my time, you know, and I've been an opening act for some of my like biggest heroes, and you're kind of
yes.
All of a sudden, you're sitting there in a.
Which is, I could give you a list of those. Let's see.
In case
you don't remember, okay. Which I'm sure you do, but we've got you opening for Alan Holdsworth, Todd Rundgren, Michael McDonald, Steve Morse, Steve Miller, Little Feat, Kansas, Adam Rafferty, CCR. There's one other guy named Steve, but I don't know how to say his name.
Steve Kimmock?
Yes, that guy.
He played with, he was a dead guy. He was a dead, he played with,
He was dead and he came.
No, he was, which was amazing. He was, he played Bob Weir and all those guys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He was, actually, I always said Jerry, that was Jerry Garcia's favorite guitar player. Anyways, you know, so as time goes on, you think the older you get, the wiser you are, and hopefully you are, but I honestly, the older I get and the longer this, you know, goes on and the things that happen, there's no explanation for it, you know?
Uh-huh.
And again, I think, and again, this is me, I think if God wants you there, you'll be there.
Really?
If not, you know what I mean? Because I didn't have any desire to do this, the Captain Beyond thing. It was the last thing.
You weren't seeking it out, in other words.
At all. All the years I had been seeking something like that, it never happened. Mm-hmm. Ever. People tell me how, oh, you're so good, you're such a great player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, well, if I'm so good, then why am I playing at the wagon wheel? Right? Oh, I'm so great. Oh, yeah, you're great. Oh, yeah, well, I'll beat the wagon wheel. I'm making $70 tomorrow. So, you know, it's just, I feel, now I've become, the older I get, I feel the more powerless. You
yes,
know?
And sometimes that's it's how good I feel. To be
that's
powerless.
How I feel. That's how I feel.
Now,
about
listen,
I'm not
let's,
seeing them right.
Let's take a break because I want to, I think we need to reset so we can talk about Rory Gallagher because I never.
A pleasure.
I've heard of him, but I never heard him before you asked me to do this, and so I listened to him, and we have a lot to say, so let's take a little break. You're not leaving, are you?
I got nowhere to go.
Okay, perfect.
I didn't have a ride.
We'll be right back. We're back. We had a nice break. I first out of the box, Rory Gallagher. Did you know his real first name was William Rory?
Is that right?
Yeah, that's what it says here. By the way, it's always been hard for me to say the word Rory.
Nobody can say it easily.
They can't?
No.
And his brother, Dolan.
Yeah, he was his manager. Donald. Really? Donald. Wait. D-O-N-A-L, right?
What
Donald?
Did I say?
Dolan?
Oh, yeah, I said the way wrong name.
You,
sorry, Donald. Did I tell you I'm a little dyslexic when it comes to only for Irish words?
Did you ever hear about the dyslexic, agnostic insomniac?
No.
He would lay in bed every night, awake, wondering if there really was a dog. I'm sorry.
Let's talk about Rory Gallagher.
Let's do it.
By the way, I'm sure that you referenced him for tonight because of his guitar playing, which is obviously a given, maybe.
Yeah.
But what
he's a songwriter.
I fell in love with his voice.
Yeah.
His voice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some quality to certain voices that you just are all in. And mm-hmm. he to me, that's what I
really you like. So you enjoy it? You liked it?
The voice.
Cool.
So, okay,
cool.
But...
Cool.
He was an Irish guy, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's an interesting thing. A book just came out about him with that his brother whatever you like to call his brother, the opposite of what I call his brother.
Donald.
Sort of said, no, that's not true. We sort of don't think that's true. But the book came out. The biography had this idea that they thought he might be autistic. Because
Rory?
Yeah. Only because his commitment to... He was one... He had one focus, and that was music. He did not have personal, close personal relationships.
Correct.
He had his music, period.
Period.
So,
mm-hmm.
Tell me what do you know about him?
I first saw him. There was a documentary on the Isle of Wight Festival, 1970. There's a well publicized documentary out there, and they had the Who was there, the Doors, Tiny Tim. I mean, it was insane. But within the
Jethro
Tull.
Yeah,
Jethro Tull. I mean, everybody, And but they showed this 30-second clip of Rory, when I was watching it. And I was like, who's Rory? I go, okay, Rory Gallagher. I go, I've heard that name. I'm going, man, he did this 30-second. They showed this 30-second clip of him. And I was like, I needed to
see
what he was all about.
Yeah.
So I went to Media Play, and I bought an album called Tattoo, Rory Gallagher Tattoo, and I brought it home and put it on, and from the very first song, which was a song called Tattooed Lady, I was like, man, where's this guy been?
Okay.
For me, because he'd been around forever, and so I proceeded to, for myself, my little bubble of musical whatever, from the year 1995, I discovered Rory right after he died.
Which, by the way, he died June 14, 1995.
Yeah, I discovered him right after he died. And I bought every album that he had and listened to every album every day. And I became obsessed with him.
Really?
Obsessed. And my wife, my friends, they were like, what is up with Jamie and Rory Gallagher? Because, like, I just loved him. I loved him so much. And,
So, interesting, he was, born in County Donegal, 1948. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. His father was employed by the Irish Electricity Supply Board. And his mother, both his parents encouraged both the boys playing music.
Mm-hmm.
He started with accordion. And at age 9, Rory received his first guitar from his parents. And he played so many instruments, like ukulele he started with, and he taught himself to play guitar. And then he got sort of obsessed with Eddie Cochran, Buddy Holly, mm-hmm. and especially Muddy Waters. Over there in the UK, they started to, or Ireland,
right.
They started getting
American blues.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so he just totally, that was his thing right there. And then so look at all the instruments he played. He taught himself to play ukulele, mandolin, acoustic guitar, slide guitar, alto saxophone, bass, banjo, and the choral sitar,
mm-hmm.
with varying degrees of proficiency. But by his mid-teens, he became experimenting heavily with different blues styles. So then he sort of just attached himself to the blues, and that was kind of it, right, from there?
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to him, his band, the band he had in the late 60s was called Taste,
mm-hmm.
and that was a trio. And there was some, really nice stuff, but I got on to his solo career, which took place, I believe, 1970 or 71 was the first record.
Yep, 1971.
Self-titled.
Deuce.
No, Deuce was the second album, because two, Deuce. First album, but, the first album had a tune, Laundromat? Is the Laundromat listed? The song Laundromat?
Okay.
I just always thought it was cool that the first line of his solo album was, "What do you think of that? I'm sleeping down at the laundromat." I just thought that was
cool. Oh, that's pretty sweet, really?
Yeah. Yeah. But he was he put out like an album a year.
It says 10 albums in the 1970s, right?
So how many, right?
I think that would make sense. One a year.
I'm no math magician. But he would make his record. It would take him about, you know, a month.
A year? Okay.
No, a month. And then they said he would tour the rest of the year. He lived nowhere. He didn't own a house. He didn't own a home. He was never married. His whole life was make a record, go on the road, make a record, go on the road. That's what he did. And it went on and on and on and on. And he was with his brother all the time. And
by the way, you said he would tour, make a record and tour. And one thing to note about him is during the heightened periods of political unrest in Northern
Ireland. IRA, yeah.
Other artists were warned not to tour. He was resolute about touring Ireland at least once a year during his career, winning him the dedication of thousands of fans and in the process becoming a role model for other aspiring young Irish musicians.
Well, here's an interesting story about that. And I'm glad you said it because you said it much better than I would have.
Or as I like to say, Wikipedia said it a lot better than you said it.
But it's true. What happened was, at the height of the, the Protestants and the Catholics were battling each other in Ireland, Belfast, he had scheduled, these concerts, and these shows were to be recorded for an album called Irish Tour 1974. And so they hired the Rolling Stones mobile unit, which recorded Deep Purple, Machine Head. And, you know, the Rolling Stones had that mobile unit that could drive across anywhere.
Was Keith driving it most of the time?
Keith was, he may have been a passenger.
Okay. All right.
I got some cool Keith stories, too, but because I saw you reading the book in your bathroom.
Yes.
And I've read that
book. But I'm going to take that right out. Did you hear what you just said?
Play Malaguena.
You said, I saw you reading the book in your bathroom.
I didn't see you, but I saw the book in the bathroom, so I know how it works. I'm sharper than I look. I mean, I pay attention.
Yeah.
I pay attention.
Yeah.
So the story about the Irish Tour 74 record was that they drove the Rolling Stones mobile unit into the alley of where this venue was in Belfast, Ireland. And there were bomb threats for going on because of Rory's concert. So not only was that an album, but they filmed it. It was a documentary. And I've watched this thing several times. And I always wondered, before I knew the history, they showed Rory backstage. I always wondered why he looked so uptight. He was back there and he kind of looked in the mirror and combed his hair and put his you know, jean jacket on. He was kind of, you know, doing this thing with his hands. And he was like, I'm like, man, guy looks like he's going to the fucking electric chair. Mm-hmm. Like, what's going on? You know, why does he look so? I mean, he's going to play in front of a sold out audience, you know. But there was bomb threats. Because he decided nobody was performing. None of the Irish acts were performing. And Rory said, fuck that. I'm playing. You know what I mean? But he didn't, of course, he didn't want someone else's, you know, people's blood on his hands if something happened. And it's like poignant, man. It's like, wow, yeah. Look at this cat, man. He's like, it's not just he's going out to play a concert in his hometown.
Right.
He's like, got the weight of the world on his shoulders. Absolutely. Like if something happens,
yep.
It's
his
fault.
Yeah.
It's his fault. And they show him, man. It's so if anybody, you know, out there listening, I mean, if you want to see a documentary that, you know, about, you know, a rock musician in something that means something, watch Rory Gallagher Irish Tour 74. It's mind blowing. Mm-hmm. And he comes out there and I mean, he destroys it, man. Thankfully nothing happened. But he was, I mean, Thin Lizzy will always reference Rory, you know. Mm-hmm. U2, you know, any mm-hmm. Irish act. Rory was the shit, yeah. You know. There's a statue of him in Cork. I mean, he was, you know. But we talked about the blues with Rory, his affinity for the blues. But if you hear him on, there's the album Against the Grain, he does this folk tune called Out on the Western Plain. His folk stuff on the acoustic guitar is like he's hypnotic. I mean, he just draws you in, you know. He wasn't the best singer. He wasn't the best guitarist. He wasn't the best songwriter.
But like all those things together.
But somehow,
yeah.
He was, for me, he was one of the most like intriguing artists.
I get that.
Like, I've ever, you know, come across.
I get that. Now
for me, you know.
I had one observation about his guitar, and I noticed it was so like sharp sounding, like so thin sounding. Like there wasn't like when I was imagining like a thicker, fuller,
right,
distorted sound. No, it's like super like sparse. Even though he's attacking it a lot, like the actual sound is very like almost like too much to take. But then to me, and then his voice is so rich that the balance two of them it together, it just brings it together.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's a really cool take. Yeah, because I've heard people go the other way. They go, I can't take his voice. And I'm like, really?
How could you not take his voice?
Do you know what I mean, though?
It's got so much soul in it.
Oh, my God. That first record I bought, Tattoo, I mean, it was just, he has a song on there called They Don't Make Them Like You Anymore. And it's like almost a Sinatra song. It's almost like a Sinatra tune. I mean, truly, it's a jazz. He had jazz in he had a couple songs, like two in particular, but he was a blues man, but he was a Bob Dylan guy. I mean, he covered so many different genres to me. And that was, you know, the beginning for me.
Can't we say one thing about that? Everything you just said is something like jazz, blues, Dylan, all those things. That's all under an American umbrella. Like, I think that's in America. That's one thing we could be. And by the way, the people in Europe are the ones who sort of recognized these roots, which at the time here we weren't paying any attention to, right?
Right.
But there was something in the water, you could say, here.
Right.
That a lot has sprung from that well, right?
Right. Sure. Oh, for sure. And it took an Irishman to, you know what I mean, yeah, to encompass that, you know. And same thing with the Stones and, you know, the Beatles and. But Rory, you know, Rory was actually chosen to replace Keith Jones in the Stones.
Really?
And not Keith Jones. He was chosen as Mick Taylor.
Yep.
He was chosen to replace Mick Taylor, but Rory didn't like the time they were taking to, you know, get things.
Oh, moving. I bet you, knowing what you're saying about him, I bet you he could never have dealt with. He was just all business, right?
He was all what he was, you know, and he could have been. He could have been a Rolling Stone, but could you really imagine? I mean,
So you're saying maybe his book would be in my bathroom right now?
Oh man, if only if that book was in your bathroom right now, it'd be leaving with me. I tried to buy his book that his bass player wrote, Jerry McAvoy. Jerry McAvoy was his longtime bass player, and I ordered it, and it never made it from England.
Really?
Overseas, yeah, whatever.
Well, that's the problem. You ordered it from Ireland, and in England they stopped it from coming over. You're mm-hmm. going to have to go over there and get it yourself.
Did you hear that?
Think about that.
And have a Guinness there?
And have a Guinness there. Mm. Well, do you want to go do that? Do you want to go there together and get that book?
I would love to.
Let's do it. Well, it's a pact, and all right. Of our 24 listeners are witnesses.
Maybe they'll all come with us.
maybe they will. Now, listen, not to end on a sad note, but yeah. I want to bring this up because his death.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I understand. In his later years, he developed a phobia of flying. And so he was prescribed a sedative, like in the in the
Valium or Xanax or something.
And whatever. He combined it with alcohol use.
Always.
And it damaged his liver.
Liver transplant.
That he had to have a liver transplant.
Didn't take. He never took, yeah. Yeah, that was always the story with him. I mean, he traveled and toured constantly, you know. The story was he would, you know, make a record for a month and then travel for the rest of the year. But he drank. He was a true Irishman. And so anytime he was sick and he took an antibiotic or took this or took that or took Tylenol for a headache, he drank. So as we all know, I mean, that's going to, you know,
it's not good for
that's going to kill your liver. And his brother talked about it too. He goes, Rory was such a force, like his whole life. He goes that when he was in the hospital after the liver transplant, he just assumed, you know, it would take and, you know, it would be a little bit of time to recover and maybe back at it. And he goes, and Donald was like, I'll never forget. He goes, that last week, you know, and I'm just looking at him and he's not waking up. And this is it. Like, he couldn't believe it because Rory was such a...
So alive.
So alive, yeah. I mean, and... like we're talking about, I mean, it was an era where you could just make records and tour on those records. And, you know, it's hard to even say if Rory ever even really made money. I know he did, but the fact that he never owned a home, you know what I mean? He just kept rolling. I don't really know any other modern day musicians that you can say that about, you know, truly. I mean, that's why he's fascinating to me.
That's one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast is because, by the way, most people don't know about him. And
right.
You don't know of any other musicians who are doing it, but there's plenty, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, is like, that's the thing about this world that we're in is like, our only gauge of success is if you know our names, right? But there's so much more to it than that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
So his life was, I think he lived his true life. He lived his calling. He was probably happy because he was doing exactly, he wasn't driving a bus unless he wanted to, right?
Right.
So we can say that much for him, right?
Yeah. I mean, I started to, I really looked into him, you know, and I really do think that the term troubadour,
mm-hmm.
that's him. That was Rory, you know. Yeah. It wasn't, guitar guy, you know, rock star guy. No, man, he was a troubadour. When he was like 15, he was in a show band. And that's what happened in Ireland. They were these show bands, like these bands, and they went on tour, and they were on stage at like, these carnivals, like the traveling circus, would go around town and they'd set up the tents and there'd be freaks and there'd be animals and there'd be trapeze artists and there'd be the band. And that's where Rory started, was in those, the show bands. And there's a song called Tattooed Lady that he does. And it's all about that life that he lived when he was like 15 years old. Hmm. He never finished high school. I mean, you know, but Tattooed Lady... And I've done it, you know, over the years. But it was like him singing about being the show band for the circus, you know, just being this, you know, kid watching this. Tattooed lady, bearded baby, they're my family. When I was lonely, something told me that I could always be where I could wish for pennies if we had any. You could meet me down at the shooting gallery. Yes, I'm a fairground baby. Wonder what made me fall for the pearly queen. And he says, I spent my youth on a canvas roof as I roamed from town to town. I'm not fooling when I say I got no school and never liked the class bell sound. He says school bell sound on the record. And from the caravan, I hear the fairground band sounding good as they can be. You know I can't be found, but if you look around, tomorrow we'll be gone by dawn. I just love him, man. And the cool thing about the Irish Tour 74 video, they show him after the concert. And I think there's a lot of relief because nobody...
Right.
You know, died, nothing happened. And they just show him at this after party, you know, like in some joint. And they hand him, he's got his acoustic guitar. He's wasted. He's drunk. and they're just strumming some folk tunes, and everybody's singing, and he's just having a great time, you know. And he had no, I'm telling you, no ego, no ego whatsoever.
And by the way, he probably had everything he wanted, you know. People can say whatever they want about a lifestyle or about, like, he didn't get married, didn't own anything, but I don't think he really cared. He had everything he wanted.
I agree. I think that's exactly it. It's all gotten, I mean, twisted over the years, right? I mean, all the success equals this, you know, success equals that. I mean, if you're a musician and you're a songwriter, all you want to do is reach the people, you know, and be able to continue doing that. I mean, do you need excess? Do you need all kinds of stuff? I mean, you know, it's humility, I think, like we've talked about earlier, some of the greatest minds, you know, of all time are humble people, you know, and I think that's Rory. And he just appealed to me instantly because he went out there with a flannel shirt and a jean jacket, you know. And
there's something about music that comes through whatever medium it is. Like, I don't care if it's through time or through even a photograph sometimes, like, or a record player or something about that energy, it comes through and it crosses all boundaries. And so, you know, authenticity when you hear it or when you see it, right?
Right.
And probably that's why he has been one of your go-to people, is because I think you're a very authentic person. But I think a lot of that has to do with where you come from and who you surrounded yourself with.
Well, you hope the good people come to you, you know what I mean, just because, for obvious reasons, you know what I mean? Like, but you're right. I mean, you want to be around like-minded people and all that, and you hope that, you know, they feel the same way, you know.
Do you feel like you've been lucky?
Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, we're a speck of sand, right? I mean, we're just this small. We're so small that any way you can get, I don't know how to explain it. Like I said, just the Captain Beyond thing, right? Like I was talking about. I mean, how did people find you? You know, I mean, of course you could say the internet, and that is how I was, you know, lucky enough to be doing what I'm doing now. But really, it's so. Keith Richards talks about in the book, in his book, the antenna, right? It's just like you got your antenna up. It's almost like if everything finds you, you know, one way or the other, when it comes to this kind of stuff, you can put forth all the effort you want to try to be somebody. But I mean, if it's not happening, it's not happening. You know what I mean? It's only, you know, I mean, how many people try to make it so hard with everything they got? They just sell their souls to try to be famous. But then you have guys like Rory and like we were talking about, and they just did what they did, and they continue to do what they did. Just do what you do. Keep doing what you do. Mm-hmm. Don't stop doing what you do. Don't say, if I don't have this by next year,
right,
I'm done. If I don't, you know, well, I'm going to do this. That's, you have to do what you do nonstop. Continue doing it. And hope you can, you know, pay the bills. Do what you know. It's what it is. I mean, there's no formula. There's no, you know, 1 + 1 don't equal 2, man. It just doesn't, you know. So
yeah, I think you have a good point there. Thank you for spending some time with me today, because great job. I am sure people are going to have a lot to think about. And by the way, people listening, we want to hear your feedback. You can email us at thegreatunsung@gmail.com. Please give us your Rory Gallagher stories, your feedback about this. We want to hear what you have to say. And please go out and hear Jamie Holka play, especially in the summer where you probably can't drive a block in Western New York without hearing him somewhere, right?
It's terrible.
And you would be lucky if you got that chance. Because I'm telling you, Jamie, you are the real deal.
I don't know. Thank you, Allison. Thank you.
All right. So thanks for coming, and we'll do it again.
My pleasure. Okay. Anytime. You tell me when, and I'll be here.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks.
Well, I don't know about you, but I learned a lot this week. I learned that the art of guitar and the art of karate are distant or not so distant cousins. I learned that one of the secrets of the universe is to pay attention. Your life is there waiting for you, if only you can see it. And I learned that when you and your friend Jamie drink Guinness and talk about Rory Gallagher, it's a great idea to listen back to your conversation the next day and edit out all the dirty jokes. I want to thank Jamie for driving from Niagara Falls to talk to me. You can find Jamie Holka and his music by going to Google and typing in his name, Jamieholka, for videos, tour dates, and most importantly, his music. Contact us at thegreatunsung@gmail.com. Please continue to review this podcast and share it with your friends. Until next time, this is Allison signing off, and thanks for listening to The Great Unsung.